your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Now, I hope everybody enjoyed that first segment where we really recapped a lot of the data points and a lot of the news that came out this week. In this segment, we are going to be focusing a bit more on the precious metals and resource sector, and in the final two segments, more on the energy sector. In this segment, we are chatting with Jeff Christian, managing partner at the CPM Group. Now, Jeff, let's start off by recapping the moves in precious metals that we saw at the tail end of last week and the very beginning of this most recent week. Gold, silver really got moving on Friday. There didn't seem to be too much news or data that crossed the wires that caused pretty much a $50 move higher in gold and then follow through mostly on Tuesday. We are recording this late in the day on Wednesday, so we're not sure how the market's finished, but I do think that move in the precious metals does warrant a bit more attention. Now, there was some social media posts that came out of China that said they might be opening up or moving away from that zero COVID policy. There's also the further weakness in the US dollar. Jeff, your takeaway from, again, this almost $100 move in about three trading days in gold and a couple dollar move higher in silver.
Yeah, I think first off, to understand the upward move, you have to look at the previous few trading days, you know, and gold and silver, along with most other financial assets, have been very weak and very volatile on a short-term basis. So, you know, gold did move up sharply, silver moved up sharply, but they moved up from very low levels, you know, and we've seen low prices now for precious metals, really for several months. You know, the prices have not been able to rise. And I think that that's been an effect that has been primarily caused by the stronger and higher increases in interest rates and the stronger dollar. And, you know, late last week, early this week, you did see a downward shift in the dollar. It's still very high relative to a lot of other currencies. But, you know, I think the markets took that shift as, oh, well, maybe the dollar's peaking. I don't know that it is peaking. I don't necessarily think it's peaking. But, you know, the markets want to believe a lot of stuff. The markets want to believe that the dollar's peaking. The markets want to believe that the Fed is about to, quote, pivot, which is a nonsensical concept, and start lowering interest rates. You know, the markets really are starved for reasons to be optimistic for both the stock market, other currency markets, and commodities, including, you know, gold and silver. So I think what you saw was you saw some signs of weakness in the dollar. You heard these comments that China might be a little bit more lax vis-a-vis Hong Kong travel for businesses. And that was grossly misrepresented in the markets as, oh, China is opening up again. China is not opening up again. China has reaffirmed its zero COVID policies. It has removed from office and power most of the people who thought that the zero COVID policies were wrong. They're cracking down. They're not getting more open. They're getting more restrictive. But the markets want to believe that China's opening and that the Fed's going to lower interest rates and the dollar is going to plateau and start to come down. And I don't think any of those things are going to happen. But I think over the last four business days, what you saw was the belief that those things were going to or were starting to emerge caused people to start repositioning long in gold and silver as well as other assets. And you saw this big bounce. But, you know, put the big bounce in context. It came from a very low level and it went up, you know, gold got up to what, 1770. Which is what a lot of people thought was $100 below the floor 6 months ago. Yeah, so you still have the markets consolidating at low bases. I do think they'll rise higher later, but I think that what you saw right now was just some wishful thinking leading to a short-term spike up.
Yeah, Jeff, I think you stated it well there where you said the markets are starved for a reason to be bullish. And, you know, what also came out on Friday that we didn't discuss there was that the jobs report came out and the unemployment number had gone up higher and it kind of overshadowed the good jobs report. So, of course, what the markets ran with was, hey, this means the Fed's going to start lowering their rate hikes as they move forward and slowing down their roll a little bit. And that was the reason to be bullish. Because the China news kind of got squashed over the weekend, yet we continue to see precious metals diverge a little bit from the general markets, from the crypto markets, which have crashed this week, and really from other sectors. So the commodities in general have done well this week, including the precious metals. And the one that seems to stand out to a lot of people is silver, Jeff, because it had actually bottomed back in September and has put in a series of higher lows. It seemed to have bottomed before gold. Are you encouraged by that, or what's your take on the silver price movement, I guess, over the last month or two?
Well, yeah, you know, my view is that the price of silver probably has been bottoming out over the, you know, it hit a low in July and August, and then it went somewhat lower in September and October. You know, we think cyclical bottom in silver, as we also think a similar one is a cyclical bottom in gold. I'm not, you know, we saw the silver price shoot up. I guess it got up to about 2170 or something like that over the last couple of days. That was an incredibly low price for most people. I mean, we thought that the price would probably stay above 18, you know, and instead it went lower and lower and lower. I wouldn't be surprised to see that this was the base for silver. I wouldn't be surprised to see the price of silver rise to $22, $23 an ounce over the next couple months, but I don't think the market's going back to $28 or $30 anytime in the immediate future. You know, maybe in the first quarter of next year, depending on certain things that could transpire between now and then. But I think for the next couple months, the price will be hard pressed to maintain the gains of the last five trading days and move a little bit higher, like I said, toward 23 or so. You are seeing continued strong interest on the part of investors for silver, some investors. Other investors continue to sell either their ETFs. You have the silver futures investors pretty much neutral now. You know, they slip into net short positions over the last several weeks and several months. So, you know, it's a mixed bag. You don't have the screaming demand for silver driving the price sharply higher. You have a lot of people who are shocked that the price of silver got as low as it did, and they're still believing that the price is going to rise and rise sharply. But there are other people who are just sort of giving up the ghost here.
So, Jeff, I've been hearing a lot about central bank buying when it comes to gold and how that could be a driver for the gold price. I've heard this argument before, and it does make sense that central banks, they can be big buyers of gold in your eyes. How are you viewing this data point? What does it mean to you when we do hear about central banks increasing their buying of gold?
Yeah, there are some reports of unreported central bank gold sales, and we're not sure that those are real. We're trying to find somebody in the gold market who has seen it. You know, it's something on the order of 10 million ounces of unreported gold sales. And I think the World Gold Council, which reported this, did the right thing. And they said these are unreported, unsubstantiated rumors of purchases subject to revision in the future. That said, setting that aside, because I think that's kind of like just bogus, what you saw was in the second quarter, as the gold price came down, central banks bought about 3.3 million ounces on a net basis. That was a pretty high volume. In the first quarter, they were net sellers of slightly less than a million ounces. In the second quarter, they bought about 3.3 million ounces. And in the third quarter, their reported purchases were net about 2.1 million ounces, I believe. So you've got about 5 million ounces of gold that's been purchased in the second and third quarters by central banks. That's a substantial amount of gold. It represents the fact that central banks do want to add some central banks. You know, there are a couple dozen central banks out of 180 of them that want to add gold to their portfolio, their monetary reserves, and they are price sensitive. So when the price was $1,880, you know, $1,900, $2,000 an ounce in the first quarter, there were some central banks selling, and there wasn't a lot of central bank buying. But as the price came from 2018 to 17 to 16, 20, what you've seen is the bargain hunting buying. So a lot of central banks have bought a lot of silver or gold rather over the last 6-7 months. And, you know, it's a good sign. They're buying, it's not historical levels, unless these phantom 10 million ounces turn out to be real. And I don't think that's the case because there's no shadow. You know, 10 million ounces, that's like $17 billion worth of gold. You haven't seen, you saw some central banks reduce their foreign exchange reserves by $17 billion in the third quarter. But like that was like Japan. And Japan was using its foreign exchange reserves to shore up the dollar, the yen. So it wasn't buying gold from what anybody can see. Anyway, the reality is that the central banks are buying gold. They have been buying gold for a couple of years. They do tend to be price sensitive. We saw in 2020 and into 2021 that they had upped their threshold and they were buying around 1800. But then when the price started to weaken, they pulled back. And then when the price got really weak, they said, okay, this now looks like a cheap price. The same way that in, you know, 2018, 2019, they said $1,200, $1,300 an ounce seemed like a cheap price. And then when the price rose, they kind of pulled back for a while. Then they started buying at the higher prices. And then they said, well, maybe the price is coming down. So they stopped buying. Now the price has come down, showing signs of being at bottom. So they started buying again. And, you know, it is a positive for gold. They won't drive the price higher because central banks, as I said, they're much more price sensitive than private sector investors. It's really going to take a renewed wave of buying by private sector investors to try to drive the gold price sharply higher.
Well, Jeff, let's talk about that idea of what could drive the gold price higher. On a fundamental basis, you know, is it going to be a supply-demand issue with the metals themselves? Is there some fiscal reasons that you think gold or silver would go higher? And or are there any geopolitical events that you think could move the metals?
Yeah, I think there are several things. You know, first off, I don't know that the only fundamental that matters really for the price is investment demand. You know, there's plenty of silver around. There's plenty of gold around. It will take higher investment demand to drive the prices of these metals higher. And that investment demand will be fueled not by perceptions or fears of shortages of metal, but rather by, you know, exogenous variables, as we would say, you know, economic problems and financial market instability, currency market volatility, and political developments. And we have a laundry list of things that are wrong with the world, things that are wrong with individual countries and regions, you know, the United States, the Eurozone, the UK, Russia, China. There are enormous amounts of economic issues. There are also big political issues. There is a reduction in international cooperation. The Chinese Communist Party Congress basically saw the removal from office and power of anybody who was a moderate person. So you now have hardliners in charge there, which is why the whole idea of China moving away from zero COVID a week after the party Congress said, no, we're not moving away from zero COVID. You know, you could think that that may have been propaganda by anti-government forces within China, honestly, you know, to see that, because it's clearly not going to happen. So China's got a lot of problems. It's going to get worse. The United States has a lot of problems. They're going to get worse. I think the results of the election yesterday will be that markets will look at what's going on. They say we're going to have a divided government. It's going to continue to be stalemated. It's going to continue to be ineffective. And it's going to continue to be vulnerable to not being able to respond to the economic and political developments that could throw us into a recession at some point in the next 2 years. So I think that you're going to have that uncertainty and volatility in financial markets expectations of what's going on politically and economically continue. That forms this basis for gold. And then when developments do happen that are negative, you can see gold prices spike. And when developments happen that are positive for the world, you can see gold spike down. So if there is a movement, a significant movement against Russia in the Ukraine, and you start moving toward more a greater likelihood of sooner rather than later Ukrainian victory, if you have Putin removed from office, or if you have continued public infighting among Kremlin higher-ups and officials, if you continue to have sabotage of Russian military sites within Russia by Russians, you know, any of those things could actually lead to weaker gold prices because there's a view that, hey, maybe we get this behind us. Then you have, on the flip side, the things that can drive it higher, reduction in oil and gas supplies in the United States, inflation being worse than people expect it to be, interest rates peaking, recessionary economic conditions. You know, there's just this plethora of things that are wrong that could get worse.
Well, Jeff, that doesn't sound great, but you know what? That's just the world I think that we're living in. Quick comment, though, because a lot has been, in terms of the market moves, predicated on what central banks have been doing. They continue to tighten, although we have seen some other central banks slow down, and it sounds like the Fed's going to be slowing down. As we move into next year, and we get an environment, let's say, where central banks pause. We're not going through rate hikes, but we're also not going through rate cuts. The general Fed funds rate, interest rates broadly, will be significantly higher than they have been in the last decade. One could argue even longer than that, especially because rates just kept on declining over the last 40 plus years. What environment does that leave for metals, especially the precious metals?
Yeah, you know, that's sort of what we've been projecting for 2023-2024. You know, the expectations, if you look at the CME's FedWatcher indices, the expectations have been that you would see interest rate hikes start to be smaller in December. You know, so 75 basis points in early November, maybe 50 basis points in early December, maybe plateauing in the first 5 or 6 months of next year, and then starting to decline in 25 basis point moves, maybe in June, but more likely probably in the third quarter of next year, wholly dependent on what happens with the economic environment in terms of employment and economic output and inflation in the United States over the course of next year. That, you know, that's been our view. It's been the market consensus, and it's probably going to be, it does seem like it's the most likely outcome. And then, you know, that supports gold at prices above 1680. It doesn't necessarily support gold at prices of 2000 or higher.
Well, Jeff, one other topic that I think we should wrap up with that includes the central bank policies, that it feeds into the CPI data that we're getting this week, is inflation. Where is it coming from? Where is it going? There seems to be a lot of confusion about where the inflation originated from, and it's a combination of factors, but also where it's heading. What's your outlook on inflation?
Yeah, you know, there's this preponderance of focus on monetary policy as the source of inflation. And monetary policy definitely has contributed to it, but the major drivers of the higher inflation that we've seen since the first quarter of 2021 have been fiscal policies by the government, a lot of increased government spending and support programs over the course of 2021 and 2022, and, you know, structural economic changes. And those structural changes have been across the board. So you can look at the energy market, because energy is very important. And I was flabbergasted last week. I had somebody tell me, and they honestly believed that the higher energy prices were completely a function of the Russian invasion of Ukraine and that the U.S. should force Ukraine to cede big chunks of its country to Russia in order to end the war so that the oil and gas can flow and drive oil and gas prices down. But if you look at the oil and gas prices, the bulk of the increase occurred before the Russian invasion. You know, oil prices were $60 like in early November last year, and they were probably 80 or higher by the end of December. So you had fundamental issues in the oil and gas markets driving prices higher before the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Russian invasion of Ukraine worsened it, but it didn't cause it. You have similar situations in other markets. You had very strong demand coming out of the lockdown in 2020. Over the course of 2021, you had very strong demand for a lot of base metals, manufactured products. And that structural economic issue in raw materials led to inflation, contributed to the inflation. You had problems in the agricultural community. You had massive issues with intrastate and within the United States and within North America and within Europe, transportation, not only of agricultural products and raw materials, but of manufactured goods. Then you had structural issues with international trade. And international trade, which is a big propellant of real economic growth, has been on the backs of its heels for several years because of the breakdown in international cooperation and the rise of international hostilities among governments. And you saw supply chain issues, they were calling it, but it's really international transportation constraints and national transportation constraints. So you had a whole series of issues. You know, you can look at housing, and housing prices have skyrocketed partly because of a shortness in supply of the kinds of houses that people want and can afford. So, you know, young people looking for starter homes, older people looking to move to smaller houses because they're empty nesters, those smaller houses are in short supply because the construction industry has incentives for building larger houses with higher margins. And so you have a supply-demand imbalance in housing. And you can go through virtually every sector of the U.S. economy and the international economy, and you can find these fundamental economic supply-demand imbalances. And those were a lot of the things that caused the inflation, exacerbated by the strong growth coming out of the lockdown in 2020 and exacerbated by fiscal spending largesse. And the monetary policy was sort of reacting to that, saying we have to accommodate the fiscal policies and the economic realities, even if we don't like it. You know, but the markets, for some perverse reason, focus on monetary policy as the cause of all inflation. And I thought that that economic argument was beaten to death 40 years ago, but apparently it was just put into a coma, and now it's come out of the coma. And people are actually believing that monetary policy is the end-all and be-all of economic activity. And it's not. I mean, you know, it's just not. But people are not looking at, maybe they don't want to face up to the economic realities in their own country and on a global basis. Or they just don't know about it.
All right, Jeff, we'll wrap it up here. Always interesting to hear what you're looking at, especially in terms of the drivers behind the resource sector. We get a whole lot of different commentary on stuff, and some people look more short-term, some look more long-term, but boy, oh boy, there is a lot to consider because it is truly a global market, and that is many of the reasons why the price can swing in directions that people aren't expecting. Jeff, thank you as always for your time. Great chatting with you. Hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
All right. Well, as always, thank you for asking.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment.